Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Food insecurity on college campuses. It's a growing problem. In fact, college students are experiencing hunger at a rate higher than the general population. There are efforts to help, and we'll hear about some of them. Also, the deaths of more than 40,000 Palestinians and 1,200 Israelis over the past year has drawn out deep divisions among Jewish college students. We'll have a report. Young people are engaged in the election process, but that doesn't mean they feel candidates are considering their perspectives during the campaign. We'll speak with some of them. We'll also talk with a crisis counselor who tells us how her life changed after her younger sister died by suicide. And several communities are dealing with unsanctioned pop-up parties that often turn violent. A mayor discusses the problem with us. Those stories and more are ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. College is back in session across the country, but some students are worried about more than just their grades and the cost of tuition. Research shows college students are going hungry at a higher rate than the U.S. population as a whole. And as Jess Savage reports, some college campuses are working on creative solutions.
At Northern Illinois University, about an hour west of Chicago, it's watering time at the campus garden. Brian Flower directs NIU's Edible Campus program. He shows off the free-to-pick gardens as the university's clock tower chimes.
So we've got some amazing stuff in here. I always love the beauty of the eggplant flower. The colors on them are beautiful.
Students picked hundreds of pounds of produce directly from the garden last year, but many don't have access to kitchens in the dorms. So Flower created a food prep program for students to learn how to make their own meals.
And I've had students who have said, if I didn't have this that I could pull out of my freezer, I'd be going from breakfast all the way to dinner, not having anything to eat.
NIU's Edible Campus is one solution to a glaring issue on college campuses across the country. Experts agree that more than a quarter of all students have limited or uncertain access to nutritious food. And universities nationwide often underestimate the number of their students who are food insecure. The Hope Center at Temple University in Philadelphia conducts research on student hunger and policy. Researcher Stacy Perniski says when students don't know when their next meal is coming from, it adds to their stress levels.
That students are regularly making decisions about which bills to pay, about whether to go to work or to class, about whether to work three jobs versus two jobs, about how much sleep they can afford based on how many jobs they have to work and when their classes are.
Perniski says the Hope Center also makes recommendations and advocates for systemic change across the U.S. Trellis Strategies, based in Texas, is a marketing research group, but the organization also does community research, including on student food insecurity. Research manager Allison Cornett says students from food insecure households are 43% less likely to graduate from college.
I just keep thinking about those students that don't make it to the end, the finish line, and just trying to figure out how we can better support them and love those students to success.
Cornett struggled to access food herself in college. She says navigating state and federal food assistance programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, can be challenging for busy college students.
They're trying to get all these different things done, and then we ask them to jump through some more hoops and demonstrate their poverty.
At the University of Missouri, Kansas City, officials wanted to make sure students had better access to food support services. So they put a food pantry in the high-traffic student center. The university also hired a SNAP coordinator to help students apply for federal assistance. Carlin Fidler coordinates these efforts at UMKC.
There's a huge stigma that, oh, if you're going to college, like, it's a rite of passage to be poor and only eat ramen. And I really don't believe that needs to be true.
Back at NIU, student garden worker Emily Larravee is inside the greenhouse, where tomato and cucumber plants are snaking their way up to the roof. Larravee says she's seen how students and the rest of the community can quickly fall in love with the garden program.
Like the other day, I went to get tomatoes, and there was a new student moving in with his parents, and his mom was like, I love gardening. And she's like, can we try the tomatoes? And it was like, absolutely, like, they're free to take.
Advocates say they want to see more campuses finding ways for students to access food. And maybe then the old idea of the starving student will no longer be taken lightly. I'm Jess Savage, Harvest Public Media.
College is often a time and place where young people are figuring out who they are and who they want to be. For many Jewish students, that experience has been especially fraught amid escalating conflict in and around Israel and Gaza this past year. The deaths of more than 1,200 Israelis last October and more than 40,000 Palestinians since has amplified divisions in the Jewish community and within Jewish students themselves. With the arrival of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, that's made fellowship with Jewish classmates both more important and all the more difficult. Lisa Kurian-Philip has this report from Northwestern University's campus.
It's the first day of class, and a handful of students are catching up over free cookies and donuts in the lobby of Northwestern University Hillel, the biggest and best-funded campus group for Jewish students at the Evanston School. Senior Adam Jaffe is tucked away up a flight of stairs in a much quieter space, surrounded by windows with views onto a rainy day. This is a special place for him.
It's been always the place that when I need to get out of the house, when I need to go for a walk, when I need to be with people and find community, that I go to, and I can, it really does feel like a home here at Northwestern.
Sari Eisen is in her second year as student president of Northwestern Hillel.
Hillel has meant everything to me.
Eisen says she's been involved with the organization ever since she attended Yom Kippur services her freshman year.
It definitely has given me the sense of community that I was looking for in college, feeling like I have some kind of connection with people who I might not even know, just because we share that Jewish identity and we share the involvement in the community and the kind of devotion to leading good life.
Many college students, away from their families for the first time, are trying to figure out who they are and where they fit in. For Jewish students like Jaffe and Eisen, the first and most obvious place to look for a community on Northwestern's campus is Hillel. It hosts religious services, but also barbecues, a running club, and even a theater troupe. Staff say it's meant to be a place for all Jewish students to find fellowship and guidance on their journey to adulthood. That mission has been made more essential, but also nearly impossible, by the October 7th Hamas attacks and Israel's onslaught of Gaza since then. The ceaseless death and destruction over the past year have drawn out deeply held beliefs that are not easily reconciled. Here's Jaffe again.
My belief that Israel has a right to exist, and yet there is vast injustice to Palestinians, has always remained pretty steadfast. And I think sometimes I have felt at odds with both of those parts of myself this past year.
It's something he's confronted with constantly, he says.
I definitely have felt on campus in this pocket of, I don't know if I really feel comfortable going to the protests, and yet at the same time, I don't want to go demonstrate for Israel as well. And so I find myself in this, isolated area.
Jaffe wants Hillel to be a place where anyone from Northwestern's Jewish community can discuss these big questions he asks himself every day.
What it means to be Jewish, what it means to question my Zionism, what it means to question the belief in the state of Israel, and to do that openly and honestly and authentically.
But inviting that kind of reflection and open dialogue is hard. Hillel considers Zionism a foundational value. The organization does not allow speakers who support boycotts and divestment over Israel's treatment of Palestinians. That makes Hillel a space where Eisen feels safe. She attended a Jewish day school growing up and has been to Israel many times. She thinks calls for divestment cross a line, that they're an affront to her Jewish identity.
For any student who feels a connection to Israel, who has been there, who has friends or family or anything, to say that, to encourage Northwestern to completely cut ties, feels, again, like they're asking a person to kind of put aside a part of their identity and say that you're welcome, but your family is not, or like you are welcome, but your country is not.
For sophomore Dan Marietta, it's another story. They are one of the students calling for divestment. I spoke with them at a protest demanding the U.S. cut off military funding to Israel. Marietta found a lot of people at Northwestern who shared their political views, but they wanted to find students who shared their Jewish identity, too.
I had a lot of friends who agreed with me about the illegal occupation of Palestine and about the horrible atrocities committed against Palestinians using U.S. arms, using the Israeli military and the Israeli government. And but I had only had one Jewish friend that felt like that. And as a Jewish person, that felt very isolating.
They gave Hillel a shot.
I got into an argument with somebody, and I had like a whole table of people arguing with me and telling me that I was like crazy. I didn't know what I was talking about. And so I just didn't want to go again.
Earlier this year, Marietta and other Jewish students started a chapter of the pro-Palestinian organization Jewish Voice for Peace. The group has just a fraction of Hillel's funding, but it's given Marietta the sense of community they so badly wanted.
All these people came together, and I met all these people I didn't know were also Jewish and felt like this, and it gave us a space to work together from that perspective. As you build up a community yourselves, you get that connection again. You get deeply more involved in your Jewish identity.
Back at Hillel, in the quiet space overlooking a rainy sidewalk, Jaffe is still wishing students like Eisen and Marietta could build a community together, uniting in their shared Jewish identity while trying to understand one another's viewpoints.
Because at the heart of Judaism is skepticism, and that is what we do best in many ways. And I think it makes Hillel at Northwestern and Hillel internationally a stronger organization to make sure that those Jewish voices are being heard.
Otherwise, the divides that keep students like Eisen and Marietta apart will only grow deeper, he says. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
Psilocybin is a hallucinogenic compound derived from certain mushrooms. There's been growing interest in making the psychedelic drug more available for mental health treatment. Earlier this year, Alyssa Eaton reported on what those efforts look like in Illinois, and today we revisit that report.
Justin Wiggs says he had a taste for adventure as a teen. He joined the Marine Corps after graduating from high school. At the time, the U.S. was at war with Iraq. Wiggs was deployed there twice.
I knew what I signed up for, but then the reality of being sent over to go fight a war is a different thing.
When he got back, he struggled. All of his friends had college stories, but he had war stories.
And was kind of thrown into the chaos of what we call civilian life, the real world. And, you know, there's a lot of safety nets that the military provides you that, you know, all of a sudden you've got to figure that stuff out on your own.
He was never formally diagnosed with PTSD. But Wig, who lives in Lombard, says he suffers from depression and a short temper. He tried antidepressants, but they didn't help. He says he had some success with cannabis, and that made him curious about other plant-based medicines. He decided to travel to Peru for an ayahuasca retreat, where participants consume psychedelic brews. Wig says it really helped. He resonates with an analogy coined by a psychedelics researcher that compares the mind to a ski slope. The shift in his mindset before and after treatment felt like a fresh coat of snow.
It's like a mountain, right? Like a ski hill. Your brain gets these patterns ingrained in it, and it might not be the best way to do it, but it's the only way that you've figured out how to do it. And then after a dose or a treatment, it's like a fresh snowfall, and it covers all those tracks and gives you an opportunity to handle situations differently than you have in the past and to just look at things with a fresh perspective and a fresh set of eyes.
The idea that the brain can be rewired this way is backed by science. Dr. Joshua Woolley is a psychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco. He's never met Wig, but many patients in his research studies report similar experiences. Woolley studies the effects of psilocybin coupled with psychotherapy for the treatment of depression. He says there's still a lot we don't know, but the research is promising. The hypothesis is that psilocybin increases the plasticity of the brain, meaning people can start to feel unstuck from their former ways of thinking, and the effects can be long-lasting.
people can get huge improvements in their mental health. We and others have shown big improvements in depression, for example. And unlike antidepressants like SSRIs, you know, Prozac, we're talking about a single dose of this drug, and then people feel better for weeks to months.
So far, two states, Oregon and Colorado, have decriminalized psilocybin and opened up access to the drug for adults in supervised settings. A bill introduced in Illinois would follow a similar model. The bill's lead sponsor is Democratic State Senator Rachel Ventura. She says the bill would set up an advisory board to determine the best practices.
There would be licensed facilitators who would be the ones sitting with you, and they would be in a licensed service center. These are not necessarily your typical doctor offices or a psychiatrist's office. Individuals would need a certain level of criteria and then go through a training program and become licensed by the state in order to do this work.
Ventura says patients will also have to meet a certain criteria and participate in a risk analysis and preparation session to see if they'd be a good candidate. Dr. Woolley at UCSF says the risk of bad outcomes are relatively low, especially when candidates are screened. But he'd prefer states wait until the drug is approved by the FDA before opening up access.
Like what they're doing in Oregon, what it sounds like what Illinois is proposing, is that it's a little bit like a pseudo FDA. It's supervised, but it's not, you can't make treatment claims because that's what the FDA regulates, but it's kind of non-specific healing. And that's a kind of a gray zone that is very challenging. These drugs are not benign. They're powerful, and sometimes people have problems.
But Senator Ventura says there's no time to waste because there's an urgent need for new mental health treatments.
We have a mental health crisis right now. We have people who are burnt out and have tried everything. They've done lots of different types of therapy, behavioral health, SSRIs, and while all of those things have benefits, for the individual that it doesn't quite cut it, those individuals are really looking for a new tool in the toolbox.
Ventura says she's made tweaks to the language of the bill in hopes of winning bipartisan support and getting this bill to the governor's desk. I'm Alyssa Eaton, Illinois Student Newsroom.
Ventura's legislation failed to pass in the spring. It could be considered when lawmakers return this fall. There's more ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Anne King was just 20 when her 13-year-old sister, Erin, killed herself. Today, the 48-year-old Kankakee woman works as a crisis chat counselor for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline and is also a board member with the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She is certified to teach classes for youth, which are aimed at combating suicide. She recently spoke with our reporter, Maureen McKinney, about her experiences.
You've been an advocate for combating suicide.
I have been, and honestly, it feels like a lifetime, considering I was really just a kid when Erin passed. And when I received the phone call that she had taken her life, number one, it was definitely not a phone call I ever expected. I had older grandparents. I thought maybe a grandparent had passed. Never when I had a call, you know, left on the answering machine to call home right away for an emergency, did I imagine it could be Erin. And I definitely had no idea that it could have been a suicide. In time, as I've learned and educated myself to be able to educate others, I learned that she was showing signs of wanting to end her life, but with the lack of education, lack of resources and knowledge, we didn't know that. I didn't know. My parents didn't know. The only people who did know were the school officials who did nothing.
How did they know?
I had wrote a note at an assembly and gave it to the gentleman in charge of the assembly who she wrote on the note asking what was the best way to end her life. And he turned around and came back to the school after he left, because a lot of the students give notes and he reads through them as they're going to the next location. And he came back, he talked to school administration and that it was very important we talk to this child. And that note was left on a principal's desk and was never touched. And Erin took her life that night.
What do you think the school could have or should have done?
If you hear something, please say something. One of the most important things is if someone reaches out to you saying that they are thinking of ending their life, you have to consider that you're the only person that knows that, and you're the person to be there for them. So just a simple thing of calling her into the office and asking her what her thoughts were and why she was feeling that way would have had that time buffer of showing her that someone cared about her. The school could have called my parents. They could have called my grandpa, who was an emergency contact, or even called me. And Erin would have felt that someone loved her and cared about her and wanted to make sure she stayed safe. She did have a party the weekend before she took her life, a Halloween party with all of her friends. They had recently moved from Galesburg to Galva, and so she got to have her Galesburg friends there. So it was kind of a moment of getting to say goodbye to her friends. She gave away several belongings, but it kind of seemed like it was growing out of things. And she had donated them to an animal shelter that was having a yard sale. So looking back at it, yes, she was doing those things. But we just thought it was normal teenage behavior at the same time. And I did see her the Sunday. I came home to visit. We had a nice family dinner, watched the football game, and I saw her the Sunday before she passed. So she had her goodbyes.
Was she having issues with mental health prior to her death?
You know, there's never one thing that causes someone to take their life. She had been a person who journaled, but the journals, when her mental health got down, we explored and we found that when her mental health got down, she tended to not write as much. So we weren't really able to explore that. She was having difficulty in school. She was being bullied in school. But I think with the mental health factors and being bullied in school, it kind of just became her perfect storm.
You have other siblings?
When Erin took her life, my mom was pregnant with my brother, Spencer. His name actually is Charles Spencer James. He was named after Charlie Chaplin because my sister Erin loved to go to the nursing homes and dress as Charlie Chaplin and volunteer entertaining the residents there. So we named him after her. And he was born less than a year after she passed. She passed in October. He was born in June. And then 2 years later, my sister Catherine was born.
Was it hard for you being so much older than your siblings?
It was. A lot of times I was mistaken as their mother, but I feel like I have something really special to be such an older sibling. Now they've both started having children, both Spencer and Catherine, and I get to be a fun auntie because my children are now grown, and it really is a blessing to have them, to see them and share about Erin with them.
Do you want to tell me about what you've learned from Erin's suicide?
I have learned that mental health doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care how young, how old, what color your skin is, how much money your family has. Mental health can hit anyone at any time. And from that, I've learned how important it is to have less errands and more survivors in this world.
You work to have that happen. Can you tell me about your efforts and what other people can do?
For AFSP, I am on the board and I teach a variety of our programs. I teach Talk Saves Lives and It's Real for Teens. Both of those give the opportunity for someone to support themselves or support a friend or loved one who is on their mental health journey. I also have become certified as a youth and adult mental health first aid instructor, which is an 8-hour course that teaches someone how to help someone in a crisis. And in the last 2 years, I added it as my occupation. I work on the 988 Suicide Prevention Lifeline.
What had you been doing prior?
I was a full-time mom. I did part-time work in my kids' school, so I had the same schedule as them. I kind of just fell into the 988 job, and I was like, I think I can do this. And so I interviewed for it, not thinking I would get the job at all. And by the next morning, I had a job offer, and I absolutely love it. It is one of the best jobs I've had. During that time, I was laid off between September and January. I said, I really like this. And that hiccup in my life where Erin passed and it was hard for me to focus on school, I'm like, she would really want me to keep doing this. And she wouldn't have wanted me to give up my college education because she passed. So I am back in school as a full-time student now as well. I want to get my master's in social work.
Isn't it hard for you to do this work?
It can be. There are moments that are hard, but the people I talk to are so grateful to have someone be there with them at their darkest moment. That gratefulness, that thankfulness, and that knowing that we are making a difference and that someone made it through the night is the reward. And it's so rewarding to have that conversation happening every day, because in 1996, when Erin ended her life, if I told someone that, they would gasp. They didn't know how to respond. I love that the passion I was given by her ending her life gave me the opportunity to help break down that stigma. So people talk about mental health just like they talk about being diagnosed as a diabetic. I am diagnosed with major depressive disorder, and I take my medication and I follow my coping skills. And, you know, sometimes that depression gets kind of heavy. And that's where I have to remember my support system, my, you know, my things that help me get out of my head. And you know what? Sometimes when I have one of those days, I need to just take them too. If it's just laying on the couch with my dogs and watching TV to get myself through the day, that's what I do. You know, I have been very open about my mental health journey as well, in hopes that people around me know that it's okay to either reach out to me for support or what they need to do to start their own mental health journey. So yes, I'm totally open about my diagnosis with depression and that I take medication for it. When I talk to kids, I tell them, you wouldn't want me to come and teach to you without my eyeglasses on, because I might wreck my truck on the way. You also don't want me to come and teach you without taking my medication, because I want kids to know it's okay to take medication for our mental health. It's okay to talk about our mental health. It's your story, it's your path, and you're steering yourself down that path. And finding your support systems, finding your coping skills to keep yourself on that path to get on the other side is a valuable, valuable skill.
That's crisis counselor Anne King from Kankakee. She spoke about what she learned following the death of her younger sister by suicide. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, there are several resources available, including the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Just call or text 988 or chat online to connect with a trained crisis counselor 24 hours a day. We're We're inching closer to Election Day. Every presidential election has its core issues. This year, Republicans are focused on immigration, Democrats on women's rights, and both sides say they're equally concerned about the state of the economy. For each of these issues, the voices of every American are being taken into account, right? Well, many young Americans feel as though their perspectives have not been equally weighed by the more mature politicians. Ethan Holder reports from Carbondale.
Emma McConnell, the president of the SAU College Democrats, says the youth are invested in the issues, but not with the candidates.
I'm disappointed with the options. I think that that is something that I've heard a lot around the youth vote, and honestly, all over the country, I've heard a lot of disapproval.
Even though some struggle to choose who to vote for, the youth still want to see some progress in our country. As most Americans know, the economy has been the most talked about topic during this entire presidential cycle. Rising inflation, rising house costs, and wages that are not keeping up has left many people worrying about their futures. McConnell says she is worried much of her generation will never own a home or even be able to retire.
I think the market's in a place right now where there's less homes than the millennials need. So I can't imagine by the time we get around to everything if we're going to have homes built until the millennials' children are old enough to create a bigger demand. And a lot of us are worried about not making enough money to get there in the first place, because if your rent is too high, you're not going to be able to save up for a down payment for a mortgage either.
Joe Biden has been our president for the last 3.5 years, which has led many young Republicans to blame these economic issues on his administration. Many say we were much better off before Biden took office. Zachary Lockhart, the SIU Turning Point Chapter president, says the COVID-19 pandemic was definitely a factor in this issue, but he believes we should have seen more of a bounce back by now.
By far, we had it so much better under the Trump administration versus the Biden administration. And yes, a lot of that did come from the global pandemic, but there is no reason the effects should have lasted this long.
Many on the right believe Trump's economy was much better than what we have now. Even with that, many are not sure his re-election will be enough to foster change. Jeremiah Hale, a member of the SAU Turning Point chapter, says he doesn't know if Trump will be able to fix many of our economic issues.
Even though I believe we should combat inflation, I honestly do not know if he can individually fix the problem of inflation. Because this seems like an ongoing issue since we went off the gold standard in the 70s.
There's uncertainty as to whether our economy will get any better no matter who is elected, but young voters are wanting some specific changes to be made. Lockhart believes we need to take a look at the tax code and make some changes.
We need to completely relook at the tax code and reestablish what percentage of income dictates what percent you are in. This is something he addressed that debate with Hillary Clinton. If you want me to pay my taxes, change the tax codes. So this is not even a party problem. This is just a rich individual problem. But even then, I think the entrepreneurs and billionaires and millionaires that make up this country and help it grow are overtaxed.
While many young Americans want to see similar changes in the economy, they are very torn on how to handle the border. Some want stricter borders, while others believe we just need a better legal way to cross. Lockhart, who is an immigrant, says we could be doing better, but we need precautions in place.
I myself am an immigrant from Guatemala. My younger siblings, both from Guatemala. My older sister is from Russia. Immigration played a huge role in the very collectiveness that is my family. When it comes to taking your turn, can we completely overhaul and redo how we think immigration? Yes, but there is still a system for a reason. We need background checks on these people coming over our border illegally. Take it from an immigrant. You have to wait your turn.
People from all walks of life are throwing out many different ways to fix this issue. However, some believe the border itself isn't even the problem. Abby Marsh, a member of the SAU College Democrats, says if we had better systems for immigrants to be successful, immigration wouldn't be a problem at all.
So if you have, given the opportunity to find jobs, find housing, things like that to establish themselves, then they'll be overall living the American dream, I guess you could say.
This issue has been dubbed the border crisis, and it has left many Americans voicing their concerns in numerous ways. McConnell believes we need to demand change, but that there has been too much racism surrounding this issue.
Generally, I think people seeking asylum are not here for violent reasons, and I think the racist rhetoric that's coming out of Southern American, immigrants, Mexican immigrants, Latina people, I don't think that that's right. I think that that's a lie that's been perpetuated because it's easier to fuel than pure immigration issue by itself.
For a lot of Americans, this will be their first chance to voice their concerns inside the ballot box. The way they vote could alter how these issues are addressed and dictate the quality of their own future. I'm Ethan Holder.
Still to come, we'll talk about Illinois' law against banning books. That story and more on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Last year, Illinois passed a ban on book bans. Peter Medlin spoke with the author of that law, the Democratic Representative Ann Stava Murray, to find out how it's going.
On a basic level, how does the legislation attempt to stop book challenges or book bans?
The legislation goes about stopping book bans by taking eligibility for Secretary of State grants away from any library that participates in book banning for partisan or doctrinal personal beliefs alone. You don't get money from us as a state entity if you are engaging in this type of partisan book banning.
So far, is the law working as planned in its first year? Have there been fewer attempts to ban books?
So we don't know yet for school libraries specifically, if there will be any school libraries that choose to opt out of our grant program because they want to be able to ban books, which is what they would have to do to ban books or not apply to the library grant application whatsoever. But the majority of libraries in our state, both academic and school libraries, rely on that Secretary of State's grant funding for incredibly important community services. All eligible applicants for public library funding, of which there were 639 this year, did file a compliance statement with Public Act 103-100. Similarly, all academic library applicants for open educational resources funded this past spring filed compliance with the new law. So the jury is out on the school libraries, but every other entity of libraries that have received grants this year have proceeded and filed their compliance statements and are in compliance with our new law. A community member might still go to the library and complain about a book's presence there. There's nothing the library can do about that, but they can point to the fact that we no longer ban books on partisan or personal beliefs alone.
Right. So there have been no removals for those reasons this year.
Yeah, correct.
I was looking back at the American Library Association's data from the last couple of years, and they track the number of attempts to restrict access to books in Illinois, and they showed that the number of those attempts went down in Illinois from 2022 to 2023. But last year, in 2023, the total number of titles challenged in those attempts actually went up. So I don't have the data for this year, with the new law in place and everything like that. But what to you does that say about kind of just the trajectory that we've been on with this issue over the past few years?
Only 4% of bans have been a result of parents or community members filing formal charges about classroom or library materials. So the bans were increasing in volume. The requests for bans were increasing in volume. And at that time, just to give you some context and background for why I even wanted to pass this bill, in my community, in Downers Grove 99, we were targeted by a hate group called the Proud Boys, who decided that they had a problem that genderqueer was in the library of Downers Grove High Schools. And so our school district board literally had to go through 6 or 8 weeks of meetings where they could barely get the work that they were meant to do done, because these hate groups would show up and spend hours and hours of public comment making the most vile statements about every group imaginable.
Is there something that you wish more people knew about?
You know, I think the lack of visibility of minority groups within our libraries historically has led to some great efforts to diversify and be inclusive and make sure that everyone can see themselves in their library. And I think that that's the important thing that I want everyone to remember, is that it's incredibly important that every community member be able to go check out a book where they can see themselves in a story. to say categorically certain people's stories won't be told because they're somehow offensive to someone else's sensibilities, then that person should just not check out the book.
State Representative Ann Stava Murray on Illinois' law prohibiting book bans. She spoke with Peter Medlin. In Chicago, if you were to be shot today, you'd be more likely to die from your injuries than you would have been just 13 years ago. That's the finding of a new report from the nonprofit news outlet The Trace. It's a stunning reversal of long-term trends in which faster response times and better medical care had for years improved the chances of surviving a gunshot. Reporter Rita Oseguera from The Trace joined Mel Ballara to talk about why.
And Rita, according to your report, Chicago shootings have become deadlier. Tell us about what the numbers say.
Yeah, so the numbers we looked at, it showed that in 2010, if in a shooting, if you were to be shot, 350 people died in a shooting. And then in 2023, that grew to 559 people who were fatally shot. And really what we looked at was the percentage as well. So in 2010, 13% of people who were shot died. And then in 2023, 19% of the people who were shot died. But just to add some context, even after the pandemic, when those overall shooting numbers started to dip, those numbers were still going up.
And you actually talked to anti-violence workers throughout the city. What did they tell you about why they think a higher percentage of people are dying from gunshots?
Yeah, so there was a few reasons, depending on neighborhoods as well, but in general, access to deadlier weapons and the ability to modify them is the main source of why these shootings have become fatal. And then on top of that, more young people are carrying guns. And just from those conversations, youth are just generally more reckless with that.
So you've got more young people carrying guns. You've got weapons that are more dangerous. And, you know, we've got the numbers. Police say they're recovering more bullets at every shooting than they used to, right?
Yeah. So we also solidified our data with some data that the Chicago Crime Lab has been looking at. And they found that in each shooting incident, the shell casings that were found, if there were 20 or more shell casings, that was about 23. And then it grew to 386 cases where there were 20 or more. So that kind of indicates that more deadlier weapons are being used because more rounds are being fired.
And I want to hear a little bit more about what you heard from these anti-violence workers. I mean, it must be kind of terrifying to work in the middle of these deadlier and deadlier shootings where you've got more bullets and more people being shot.
Yeah, it's very difficult. From my conversations with them, it's really difficult to see young people being shot, but also being the shooters in these cases. And they're really in the front lines of gun violence prevention. And they go there on the scenes and they mitigate these fights that they're trying to not escalate them, right? They're trying to make sure that it doesn't lead to guns being taken out and people being shot.
I should note that while Chicago still does have a lot of gun violence, shootings and homicides are trending downward, and that follows national trends. But the people that you spoke with, Rita, said guns are more prevalent than ever, especially among young people, right?
Yes. So it's kind of the idea of the story came from, right? We were looking at how shootings were going down overall, but then we found some neighborhoods they were going up. And what we found is that there's not more incidents happening, but more deadly incidents.
And was there anything in your research that surprised you when you talked to the people who are trying to keep peace on the streets or even seeing some of these numbers?
Yeah, I think the most surprising thing is the use of social media with shootings and how a lot of violence prevention workers are actually tracking the problems that young people have with each other and trying to get to those people and de-escalate them before they become a shooting, before someone dies, right? So I think they're doing amazing work to try and reduce this gun violence.
That's reporter Rita Oseguera of The Trace. She spoke with Mel Ballara. The town of Normal is dealing with a problem that several communities are facing, large unsanctioned parties that have led to violence. In Normal, just last weekend, during Illinois State University's homecoming, one of those parties turned fatal. They're often viewed as pop-up events that are loosely organized on social media. Eric Stock spoke with the Normal mayor, Chris Coos, about the efforts to curb such activity.
These are something that we have to come up with a strategy, a combined strategy as a community, Illinois State University, Town of Normal, especially Illinois State University student body, to craft a solution. I don't think anybody would like to see a repeat of it, even close a repeat of what happened Saturday night. So I think it's up to us to coordinate a strategy to deal with this proactively. Now, the difficult part of that is so much of this happens instantaneously on social media, and it's very, very hard to track. But so that's something we're going to have to deal with.
Who all needs to be in on that conversation?
I think Town of Normal, probably City of Bloomington at some point. That's not to say it's strictly a Normal issue. It could happen in Bloomington. Illinois State University, State University student government. I think we have to have a comprehensive look at this and buy in from all those parties named to get to some solution on this.
As we had indicated, this had gone on several times before this past week, though these might be the two larger examples, referring to not only the incident Saturday night, but also the one late Friday night, early Saturday morning, that also led to gunfire. These were both during homecoming week, where more people are naturally going to be in town. Is there an expectation that these may die down after this, or is that something you can't afford to risk?
Well, obviously, we can't afford to risk this kind of event happening again. You have to understand that there are multiple types of pop-ups like this. Some of them are organic to Illinois State University population. We're beginning to see a lot of evidence that this one was not an Illinois State University pop-up. And so I think we've got a lot of areas that we have to pay attention to get on top of this.
Well, you're alluding to something that we have seen a fair amount on social media, discussion about these parties being made up of people who aren't from here. Many of them are from the Chicago area, and they are here to cause chaos. That has been the narrative that has been established. How accurate of a portrayal do you feel that is?
I can't say at this point, Eric. I don't have enough information one way or another. This is the trending information I'm getting, but it's something we have to look at collectively.
How do you feel the police department has handled this so far?
You know, it's. I'm going to refer you to the two police chiefs that were primarily involved in this. My personal reaction is I think they handled it properly. They were in a situation where they were trying to get something under control without escalating the issue.
It is reminiscent in that thread of what happened here in 2020 following George Floyd, where police in Bloomington and Normal were largely hands-off when there was looting going on, and it seemed as though this was strategic to avoid escalating anything. Now, in this case, you have one person dead, another person critically injured. Can that same strategy apply to this case?
Again, I'm going to refer you to the two police chiefs to talk about that, as they were hands-on with that event. But the sense... my overall sense is they were trying to maintain order and to prevent bodily harm from happening. And they were unsuccessful in that, but I'm certainly not faulting them for that, given the volatile situation that they were dealing with.
Have you heard from residents, perhaps those on campus or not, that feel that there's a concern that they may have for their safety?
I definitely have. That's an ongoing concern, and that's why it's my number one priority right now, the Town of Normal, and speaking with President Tarhouli earlier today, it's certainly top of mind for him. So we will be addressing this very aggressively going forward to craft a solution to prevent this from happening again.
If the Normal Police Department came to the council and said, we need more resources to be able to make this an effective response, what happens then?
Given the current situation, given that the Town of Normal and Illinois State University have worked so hard to make Normal and Illinois State University a safe and welcoming community, my sense is my council would wholeheartedly support that.
Has the town had discussion with property owners, the gas stations that have been having to deal with this? So presumably they're getting them because the police are directing them off of town property in these parks.
We haven't had that conversation yet, but I'm sure that conversation will take place.
Is there anything further that needs to be a part of this conversation going forward?
One, we have to proactively take steps to prevent something like this happening in our community again. And we need collaboration between Illinois State University, the Town of Normal, and Illinois State University student body to address this head on.
Normal Mayor Chris Coos talking about the efforts to handle large pop-up parties, some of which have turned violent, including one last weekend where a person was shot and killed, another seriously wounded. That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being with us and join us again next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.